This is Sports Talk with Earl Robinson from AM 870 WKAR. This program content is made possible in part by WKAR listeners.
And a very good afternoon. Welcome to Sports Talk 870. I'm your host, Earl Robinson. I'll be with you until 2 o'clock discussing sports with you. So just give us a call at 355-9527 or toll free 877-9527-870. Our email address, sportstalk@wkar.org. Well, you know, the Tigers won their opening game yesterday. It made the Tiger fans and the people in Detroit very happy. So we're going to talk about the Tigers today with our good friend Gary Gillette from our Major League Baseball Insider. He'll tell us more about the Tigers and how the Tigers are going to fare this week, this year, that is. So let's bring in our good buddy Gary Gillette. Gary, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing fine, Earl. How are you doing?
Hey, great. It's a pleasure talking to you again for another year of baseball. And, you know, we must say the Tigers got off to a good start, of course, yesterday. They've only got 161 left to go. But as we talked about before, is there anything you can see or tell us as to why? Let me ask you, why the Tigers might not win the division. Just about everybody seems to think they're going to win that division hands down.
I think they are going to win it. I don't think this team is as good as everyone thinks. I mean, people have gotten carried away the same way they got carried away in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I know that people don't want to hear about 2008. It was a last-place club. But the point is, at this time in April, in 2008, everyone thought the Tigers were going to the World Series. And it didn't, and they finished last. So this is a really good club, but it's got some problems, the primary problem being defense. If they play the lineup they're talking about playing, with Cabrera at third, Fielder at first, Rayburn at second, Delmon Young in left, they're going to have a really bad defense. I mean, really bad. And I don't think they're going to end up with that arrangement. I think they're going to have to improve their defense by moving Cabrera to first or DH, and anybody at third will be a big improvement defensively, Kelly, or maybe even Inge. And I don't know what they do with Delmon Young. Young is a terrible left fielder. I suspect that he won't be the regular left fielder by midseason. But they should win the division. I mean, Cleveland could mount a challenge. I think the Twins are going to bounce back if Morneau and Maurer are healthy like they're supposed to be. The Royals have lots of young talent, but I don't see anyone catching up to Detroit unless there's some serious injury, like Verlander goes on the DL for half the season, Valverde slumps, you know, that kind of stuff. Without those kinds of things, they're going to win going away.
Okay. Well, what will you say? What will propel the Tigers to win the division outside of the obvious, outside of Fielder, Cabrera, Valverde, and Verlander? What parts of this team do you think will have a bigger impact than what we will obviously see?
Well, I mean, their starting pitching looks really good. The bullpen looks really good. The hitting looks really good. It's their defense. The other thing I would say, they're going to hit into a lot of double plays. Yesterday was just a foretaste. They're going to hit into tons of double plays because they got a lot of slow guys. They're going to have a lot of guys on base, and they hit the ball really hard, which makes for a good double play. If the fielder catches it, you know, then you've got you can turn too easily. They're a solid team except for their defense. I think they'll adjust their defense. People think that Delmon Young is a terrific hitter because he had a great couple months with Detroit last year. He's not. I think they'd be, you know, ultimately they'll end up replacing Young with somebody who's a better fielder and probably just as good a hitter. And if they could, you know, both Fielder at first and Cabrera at third are going to hurt them defensively. If they can put one of them at DH every day or rotate them at DH, that would solve another defensive problem. You know, they're a team that should win. I you know, really am looking at the postseason and seeing, you know, what's going to happen there. Last year they beat the Yankees, and it's always nice beating the Yankees, but they lost to the Rangers. This year, you know, maybe the World Series. I think anything less than the World Series will be a disappointment this year. Even yes. Going to Game 7 of the LCS will be a disappointment. I think the excitement generated by the Fielder signing, by Verlander winning the Cy Young and MVP, you know, that's really carried over to got to get to the World Series. The fans are going to be disappointed.
Hey, Gary, one team I've heard a lot about, and I want to get your opinion. I've heard a lot of good things about the Cleveland Indians. How good are the Indians could potentially be this year?
I think that they're going to be good. That is a winning record. Last year, if I remember correctly, they finished right at 81 wins. You know, I have friends who work for the Indians, and I talk to people. And, you know, the Indians surprised themselves last year. They weren't projecting themselves to be contenders in 2011. They were really looking at 12 if things went well, 13 otherwise. And I think they have plenty of talent. And if they don't have any important injuries, they could give the Tigers a run, although I would expect they would fall substantially short. That is at least 5 games short of Detroit. You know, I think that if they're close to Detroit and the Tigers are struggling, then maybe they go out and make some trade deadline moves that would help them get over the top. You know, last year they surprised everybody, including me, by going out and getting Jimenez at the deadline. And, of course, it didn't work out the way they expected. He didn't pitch nearly as well in the AL as he did in Colorado, but they still went out and made the move. They made a couple of moves. So they're no longer, you know, we've always got to sell players at the deadline. They're somebody to worry about.
And that's good for them because they've been downtrodden for so long. Any other teams in that division do you think can give maybe not give the Tigers a run, but who'll be in the battle for that second spot?
Well, the Royals. You know, everyone talks about their young talent. They've got a lot of young talent, but it has to gel, and they have to show the ability to assemble a critical mass. I would think the year for the Royals to really be pointed at would be 13. They could surprise a lot of people this year. I would think second place would be a real accomplishment this year for them. The White Sox don't look very good. They had a disastrous year last year, and they cut payroll, made some trades, let Burley go, free agent. I don't think the White Sox can do much. The Twins, it really depends. I mean, if, you know, Mauer and Morneau were MVP caliber guys, and to lose both of them and unexpectedly, I mean, no one projected Mauer, that weird leg injury he had, and no one of course, could have anticipated Morneau's concussion. You can anticipate the effects of the concussion, but you can't anticipate a collision and a concussion. If those guys are healthy and back to their previous form, that would make a huge difference, and the Twins could theoretically contend. I think the odds of both of them returning to MVP form and everything else going right so the Twins contend is not likely, so I expect them to be middle of the pack at best.
Okay. What about New York and Boston? They are, as Miami, I guess, and some other teams, or not Miami, but Florida and some other teams, going to combat them, or is it still going to be New York and Boston in the East?
Well, you know, it's New York, Boston, and Tampa Bay,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
The Rays. You know, I'm tired of underrating the Rays. I seem to underrate them all the time. I think the Rays could win the division this year. It's hard to know about the Red Sox. On one hand, I think that this is a team that isn't going to be able to beat out the Rays and the Yankees, so I picked them to finish third. I picked the Rays to finish first and the Yankees to finish second and the Red Sox to finish third. On the other hand, the Red Sox have a lot of talent. They have enormous resources. You know, they can go out there and upgrade themselves at the trade deadline. They've made some smart moves. You know, I like the fact they were willing to let Papelbon go. The Phillies seriously overpaid for him. And even though he's very popular, it takes courage to let a guy like that go and take the fan disappointment. But I think it was the right move. There's no way you should spend that much money on a relief pitcher. And they're better off, you know, filling their closer vacancy from any number of talented arms they have or can acquire.
What about Texas and California? Those are the only two teams out west, or they're going to have some more trouble in that division or some more competition in that division?
You know, I don't really see Seattle or Oakland contending, so it really is Anaheim and Los Angeles of Anaheim.
Yeah.
It's the Angels and the Rangers.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Angels are a really well-run club. Obviously disappointed last year. The Pujols signing in the long run, I'm really concerned about that, but in the short run, it should boost them. Even Pujols in an off year is pretty damn good. And the Wilson signing should help them, and they have the money, and they have the money to go out and still do something if they need something during the season. So I pick the Angels to finish ahead of the Rangers in the West. I don't see, as I said, anybody else contending in the West.
Yes, when you look at all these divisions and the teams that are spending money, it seems like some of the teams that we used to didn't talk about spending money are now in that spending money category. Have you seen that around baseball in general, that more teams have more money to spend?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's partly because you have some better capitalized owners. I mean, look at Milwaukee. The C-League ownership period was marked by scraping nickels together in many ways. And, you know, the current owner, Attanasio, has money to spend and is spending it. He's being rewarded by, you know, capacity crowds. The Brewers have drawn $3 million several years running. And I don't know, if you asked me 5 years ago, if I'd ever thought Milwaukee would draw $3 million, especially to that ballpark, which I think is, you know, a white elephant. But, you know, a winning club, a winning, exciting club where the fans have faith that the ownership is committed to winning, that does a lot for you, and you can do really well. And so you see the Brewers being a factor. Obviously, they're not big spenders, but they can go out and spend. Look, they signed up Brian Braun to, you know, locked him up twice to long-term deals. As the first deal was, of course, long-term in the sense of a guy who hadn't even reached arbitration eligibility. You see other clubs like the Marlins. Now, the Marlins aren't really a small market club. They just played like it. But in the new ballpark, they're going to play with the big boys. And they went out and spent a lot of money. Washington has always had tons of money, and they're going to throw it around. Now, that assuming that their team improves, they're going to start throwing their weight around. They already have, but they're going to throw it around even more. The Cardinals have plenty of money. They did not retain Pujols. I think at the price that the Angels signed him, that was probably smart. But they have lots of money because they have an incredibly loyal fan base. The Cubs have always been big spenders, not smart spenders. The Cubs are going to spend a lot of money under the new management. I mean, not ownership, but under Theo Epstein as president. They're going to spend a lot of money. The Angels have lots of money. They're going to keep spending it. The Rangers, of course, are now that they're out from under Tom Hicks and his mountain of debt. I think that you're going to see the Dodgers spend a hell of a lot of money now that they've got new ownership. And the new ownership spent so much money to acquire that club. I mean, more than $2 billion. They have to put a good team on the field to justify that, to put a return on their investment. The Giants, of course, have money. I mean, the game is so profitable now. There's so much profit in baseball, and so many clubs are making a lot of money that it's the minority of clubs that are like Pittsburgh and, you know, Kansas City. Another example is the Astros. Now, the Astros have not been big spenders in recent years, partly because they went out and squandered a lot of money on a bunch of free agents like Carlos Lee and made a bunch of bad deals. They're going to spend money now. Their new owner, Jim Crane, has got money. He didn't get that club to just sit on it and finish fourth or fifth and collect his TV payments and maybe some revenue sharing checks. He's going to spend money. So, yeah, you're going to see this, and it will drive salaries up. But you know what? The fans like it. The fans like it when their owners spend money. You know, there are a lot of people in the media are worried about when the Tigers sign Prince Fielder. Can they afford it? Well, you know, from the fans' point of view, they can afford it because it's not their money. Fans like Prince Fielder. They like having a guy like that in the lineup. I think he's going to be tremendously popular here, and it was a very smart move. Did the Tigers overpay? Yeah, I think so. But it's not the fans' money. And you know, people will say, well, it is the fans' money. They're going to have to pay for it ultimately. But they don't have to. They don't want to go to the games. The Tigers stink, and Fielder's in the lineup 3 years from now, and the fans don't want to go to the games. They don't have to pay for it. And if the Tigers jack up the prices too much because Fielder's in the lineup and they need to pay for his salary, then people don't have to go. So it is a question of the ownership is committing the money, and that's, I'm amazed at amazed and impressed that the Ilitch ownership wants to spend that kind of money, but they do, and that gives the Tigers a huge advantage in the AL Central. I mean, the AL Central right now is probably the cheapest division in terms of clubs willing just to spend money, with the White Sox retrenching and the Twins retrenching somewhat and the Indians and Royals in economy mode. This allows the Tigers to be like the Yankees of the Central.
Okay. Hey, Gary, it's always a pleasure talking with you, my friend. We'll have you back on around. And the next time we'll have you on, we'll talk a little bit more about the money and how the money's being spent by Moore. And are some of these long-term contracts are good? We'll talk about that the next time. Joey Votto and Prince Fielder, all these guys have a contract that might take them into their early 40s. And we'll talk about that the next time we have you on, buddy.
Okay, Earl, I'd be glad to talk to you later, you know, late April, early May, whatever.
Okie dokie. Okay? Yep. Hey, thanks
a lot. Take care.
Thank you, Gary. Bye-bye. And that's Gary Gillette talking baseball with us right here on AM 870 WKAR. 21 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for more sports talk after this short break on AM 870 WKAR.
Where did humans come from, and how did we come to dominate the planet? I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the origins of Homo sapiens with Ian Tattersall. Plus, get acquainted with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the engineering student and science geek. That's on Science Friday from NPR.
And that's NPR Science Friday coming up at 2 o'clock right here on AM 870 WKAR.
Our weather forecast today will be sunny and our high will reach the upper 50s. It'll be mostly clear tonight with areas of frost again. Look for a low down to 28. Sunny tomorrow, the high 61. The high on Sunday, 59. Mostly sunny, but a slight chance of some rain Sunday. I'm Scott Paul.
And give us a call. Our lines are open, 355-9527. Toll free, 877-9527-870. Our email address, sportstalk@wkar.org. Well, you know, we haven't had a lot of talk about the U of M, so I figure we'd do that today. We'll talk about the University of Michigan football team and how their spring practices is going with a man that follows U of M quite closely, Mark Snyder. Mark, how you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. Glad to talk to you, Earl.
Hey, glad to talk to you, too. Hey, how about this Michigan team this year? What do you see spring training that makes you think this is going to be, they're going to be able to carry on like they did last year?
I think that they're complacent. I think that they realized that last year, you know, like almost everything went right, and they had a great season. 11 wins, you know, with the group they had, I think was, you know, many people would consider maxing out. And I think that they played at a high level the whole season. I think they realized that there's a lot to work for, and this team could be more talented this year, and clearly the schedule's more daunting. So they need to continue at a high level, and they're not really resting on anything that happened last year.
What about this quarterback situation? We know who the starter is going to be, but what about this backup? I keep hearing that Devin Gardner might be moving to receiver spot. Then you've got the other quarterback. How do you see that quarterback situation playing out?
I think it's versatility. I think this is modern college football, and if you can deal with versatility, that makes a lot of sense. And I think Gardner wants to get on the field. I mean, he's 6'4", and he's long, he's fast, he's athletic, so you got to get him out there. I mean, use him at wide receiver, use him as a backup quarterback, use him a little bit of everywhere, and use him and Robinson at the same time. That makes them deadly. They can interchange, they can switch spots. You know, I mean, how if Robinson's going wide on one play, Gardner's under center, and your man, you told him, well, you're suddenly you switch, and you got Robinson who's 6 foot, and you got Gardner who's 6'4". Well, you need a different cornerback or you need different help if you got different guys who have different skills that way, and they can switch on every play. It really makes Michigan a lethal combination.
What about, we've heard a lot about their interior line. How do you see the offensive and the defensive line coming along?
Well, the one thing about those two lines is they were both very successful last year, and they both have gone under major changes. The defensive line lost three starters. Obviously, Rand Van Bergen is well known, and Mike Martin, of course, and even Will Heininger, to a lesser extent, was known. And those guys all were veterans. They were all, you know, fourth and fifth year guys, and you knew what you were going to get from them in terms of effort, in terms of intensity, in terms of leadership and production. Now, you've got some guys who have been in the system, but they're all moving around to different places. You know, they're moving some guys inside, Jabril Black and Craig Rowe, to places where they have to be bigger, but they can use some of their speed more. And then you've got younger guys on the outside who are even faster and more athletic, but are more versatile as well, in Jabril Black. And then, and so I think that there's a lot of different things that this defensive line provides, but it's really one that's unknown. In terms of the offensive line, they lost All-American center Dave Mulk, and that's maybe the biggest thing, because obviously that's, you know, everyone points to the left tackle protecting the quarterback, but the offensive center is the one who makes the calls. He's the one who has to protect the quarterback up the middle, and in terms of the run game, he's probably more important than the tackle, because he has to be able to, you know, make sure they get a push right to begin with and snap the ball. There's a lot to think about, and that's going to be Ricky Barnum, probably, who's a talented player but has never gotten on the field because of injuries or opportunity or whatever it was. So he's going to be in there with Robinson, right, feeding Denard Robinson right in the middle, and I think that's going to be the interesting thing. They have a potential All-American tackle on the left side, Taylor Wan. He's still there, and this will be his third year starting, so he really has a lot to prove, and he can reach that elite level. And on the other side, they have a very athletic guy named Mike Schofield, who played guard last year and played it well, but he's athletic enough to play on the outside too, opposite Lewan. So their lines both are very impressive, and I think that they can do some damage, but I think the issue is that there's no depth on either one. So if they get past that first group, there could be some trouble.
Well, I know we've heard a lot around here about how Michigan is doing, is basically has passed Michigan State again in back to recruiting. It's like the old days of recruiting. It's Michigan, then everybody else other than Ohio State. How do you see them doing this recruiting? Are they as good as everyone says they are?
Well, I'm no expert in recruiting. I can definitely say that. But just judging from the rankings and the people who do this for a living on a day-in, day-out basis, Michigan has a class that's, you know, two-thirds full already, you know, with 15, 16 guys, and nearly all of them are four-star recruits or higher. And I think when you have, you know, to get a lot of players early, that's one thing, but to get a lot of great players early or highly rated players early, that really says about the impact you're having in recruiting. Whether it's at Michigan State's expense or not, I think D'Antonio has proven that the star ratings really don't determine how good his teams are going to be. Obviously, you know, Kirk Cousins and, you know, so, I mean, he's gotten some elite players, no doubt, Lawrence Thomas, you know, Will Golston, these guys, but he's also taken players who are less heralded and turn them into great players. So I think that, you know, people will put a lot of emphasis on recruiting, and obviously you want to get the highest rated players because those are guys who are projected to be the best players. So obviously, but it doesn't necessarily translate directly.
And, you know, we'll be looking at that. You know, Michigan has always been a good program. And, yes, they fell off the wagon for a few years. It looks like they've righted the ship. They're back zeroing in and having good players coming into their system. Is that, are people about, basically, I guess I should ask, are people happy about that now? Or do they think Michigan still has a ways to go in some areas?
Well, I think so. I think people always want more, especially Michigan fans. You know, they spent all those years, you know, spoiled by all of these bowl appearances consecutively and never losing more than seven games, except for, you know, for the most part, and competing for Big Ten championships on a regular basis and being highly rated. And those are things that just they took for granted. And maybe they appreciated it a little bit more, I think, now, because they see the difference. And when you have some down seasons and how much that can really affect your psyche and, you know, affect the perception of the program. So I think that they appreciate what's going on. You know, they always want more, just like everyone else.
How do you see the running game and the passing game at this time?
Well, I think the running game definitely is going to be strong. Robert has rushed for 1,700 yards and then, you know, 1,200 in the past 2 years, so he's going to be great. And Fitz Toussaint, you know, really with half a season of work, rushed for over 1,000 yards last year. So I think that everyone thinks the running game will be very solid. They got experience there, and they're getting some depth behind Toussaint, so there can be some versatility there too. So there's a lot they can do there. And Robinson and Toussaint learned to work off each other too, which made both more dangerous. The passing game, I don't know. I think last year was pretty spotty. You know, there was a lot of jump balls that Junior Hemingway turned into things, but, you know, Robinson was really inaccurate, and he made poor decisions in terms of interceptions and when he could throw the ball away, and when just to tuck it and run, and I think those are things he has to work on. He's admitted this spring he has to work on them. So that's really, and they don't have a lead receiver now. And that's one of the reasons I think the Gardner thing makes sense as well, because he's someone who's athletic, he has size, which they don't have in most of their other receivers, and they need to find someone who can play with the lights on. I mean, Roy Roundtree, a couple of years ago, the last year, you know, he went from 2 catches 2 years ago to something like 19 catches last year or something, some absurdly low number. So they need people who can catch the ball quite a bit, and they need to be a threat because then it opens up the running game. So not just for big plays like it was last year. The passing game was almost entirely revolved around big plays. They need mid plays and things that small, short passes that can turn into big gainers too.
Well, one area, you know, they had some success, but probably it was sporadic, I think, for most parts, but kickoff return and punt return. How do you see kickoff and punt return should that get better this year?
It has to be. If it's not, then Michigan's playing with fire. I think that was maybe the difference a couple times in, you know, what could have been even a better season than 11-2, or putting some distance and not needing comebacks and stuff like that. I think that the field position was a real issue for them, and they had to have these long drives that put a lot of pressure on Robinson in the offense because they had to put it all together to go so far. I think that that's a place where they're going to look at younger players. I think those young players are people who don't have the other responsibilities in the game, have fresh legs, and come in and make an impact. Obviously, you play your best players, and if they can do both, they can do both. But I think that they realize the need for impact on those return games. And even if it's not blocked correctly or someone makes a mistake on a block, they need a player back there who can create when everything breaks down.
Do you see this team is having a lot of spots where you're going to have a lot of players coming in and playing cold? They're going to have to use a lot more freshmen, or do you see them basically using players that have been redshirted thus far?
Well, I think that they're going to give freshmen the opportunity. They have three freshmen who were early enrollees, and they're all pushing pretty hard, it sounds like. You know, they're competing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Joe Bolden, that linebacker, it sounds like he's really in the mix, and he could be in the two deep maybe. There's a lot of impact, I think, from those young guys. And I think that, you know, this freshman on the line, they can get into the two deep because both lines don't have a lot of depth. I mean, you don't want these people to come in and be starters. But Michigan coaches proved in their first year last year that they'll play freshmen. They played Blake Countess at the cornerback. They played Desmond Morgan at linebacker. And Frank Clark, a little bit on the defensive end. I mean, these are guys who came straight out of high school. And they, by the end of the year, they were all making big impacts on the team. So I think they're afraid to do it. Those guys just have to prove themselves.
Yeah, and that's one area where they could be very strong at if the young players come along. Well, all, you know, every school seems to have that. Michigan State will have a few young players this year. You know, they rely a lot on the redshirt freshmen. Michigan State's got their program now to whereas you know they every class is redshirted just about. So Mark D'Antonio was able to rely on guys who are basically in their second year. You know, they've played a little bit. You know, they can play redshirt freshmen. You see Michigan probably heading into that direction, trying to want to rely on more redshirt freshmen?
Of course they'd like to do that. They'd like to, you know, be able to redshirt everyone. But, winning games is a priority, and guys are willing, they want to play. You know, I think guys don't want a redshirt if they come there, and I think that that's part of maybe what spurred some of this class and how successful it's been, is that they can go into living rooms and they can say, look at last year, okay? We walked into this place, and they had, you know, recruiting classes. They had some good players there, but these freshmen got to play because we let everyone compete for every job. We don't care what class you are. If you're the best player, you're going to play. And I think that, you know, I don't know if that happens in all established programs where coaches have been there a while, because those coaches say, well, we prefer to redshirt you. I think that Hope doesn't say that. I don't think they prefer to redshirt anyone. They want to play the best players, and if you look like you need to be redshirted, so be it. But they want to, every year, they want to get them in. I mean, if you're planning for five for those fifth year down the road, well, that's an ideal, and I think that's great. But a lot of things change in those 4 years: injuries, new younger players coming in, competition. So if you're planning on a whole class, you know, 5 years down the road, that seems to be, you know, it seems to be ambitious, I guess, at best.
Hey, let's switch over to basketball. Do you see Trey Burke going, or do you think he'll stay at Michigan? What have you heard on that situation?
If you had asked me early last week, I would have said he was gone. I mean, from what I understood, that was his mentality. And that was his plan. And then when the news got out that that was his intent, I think the backlash really made him think. It gave him pause. It was something he hadn't really considered. And I think that now he's thinking about it hard. I think that he's back to reconsidering it, even though he was set in one direction and ready to go in that direction. And I think that now he's really pondering. I think he's not really sure what he's going to do. And, you know, indecisiveness never leads. It probably doesn't lead to leaving. And if it does, then, you know, you're really taking a lot of chances. Because hopefully, you know, if he's going to go, I think that he probably has to get to a point where he's entirely confident in that decision, maybe back to where he was really last week. Because you got to feel good about, because you got to do your workouts, you got to show your confidence, and the team's got to believe that you want to be gone. You know, that you're working out at your full, that you're ready to step into the NBA, especially when you're a young player. So I don't know where Trey's headed at right now, but I think that the fact that he's reconsidering is good for Michigan, you know, from where he was last week.
Yes, and you have to think, because I know he's probably had to hear all these things. You need another year of strength. You need to get stronger. You know, you probably, you know, got a little stronger and get in the weight room. And also just learn your guard skills a little bit more and try to get better at that point. And, you know, that's the thing. A lot of these kids think they're ready when they're really not ready. But that's something, you know, everybody has to put up with.
Well, Earl, I think that maybe I approach this differently than most people, but the way I look at it is people have to maximize their potential, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have to look at many factors beyond just where you're projected, beyond just what you've done and what the future is. I think you need to look at when you will be at your highest point, okay, in terms of being either selected or ready or whatever. You know, maybe he would gain something by coming back, or maybe in his mind it wouldn't be enough to spend a whole year there where he could be developed instead on an NBA bench by professional coaches and spend all of his time working on that. I mean, I think there are lots of factors that we don't know about that he's considering. And maybe he's looking at Michigan's roster next year, which could be very talented. But this year his numbers were so good because Michigan relied on him so much and they needed him to do things for them. Whereas next year, maybe he won't have to do quite as much because, you know, there's going to be more talent around him. I think that those are all factors that need to be considered. And, you know, we don't know personally what he thinks. We don't know about his family. Obviously, his parents are very solid people from our interactions with them. They've been, you know, they're educated. They have a job, all these things. But we don't know what their personal situations are. And we can't get in kids' heads. We don't know what they've discussed amongst their family. And I think that for us to speculate on whether he should or should not go is really a disservice to him because we don't know all the facts.
Okay. Hey, Mark, got a question for you from Dave from Kalamazoo. Got a question for you on women's basketball. Dave, how you doing?
Well,
very good.
Well, good. You know, obviously better than Michigan's basketball team right now. Women's team, anyway. Yeah, I just wondered if he could give some insight. You know, when Borsas came in there, you know, several years ago, five years ago, it was a tough situation, and they'd had two coaches before that had pretty rough rides too.
Okay.
Borsas seems to be making progress, and it isn't very often that a guy takes a step back. And I know he's from, you know, Western UP, so Green Bay's closer to home, but you know, they said he signed some good recruits, including this year's Miss Basketball. And then I see, I don't know, several weeks ago, the assistant coach ahead of recruiting just left the program. The Detroit Free Press alluded to maybe Mr. Borsas and A.D. Brandon not getting along. And
okay.
I can't pronounce her name, Dawn Trzik or something. She was the Grand Valley women's coach and had been a player for Borsas.
Okay, well, let him answer the question. Yep.
She's interviewing for Western. So okay. Could you sort of set us on what's going on over there? Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, one of Earl's regular guests, Mick McKay, covers women's basketball for us, so he could be able to speak more towards it. But what I'd say is, you know, it's like the Burke situation. I think there were a lot of things involved with Borsas. I don't think there was one tipping point necessarily that changed his mind, but he saw a lot of things. And you know what? A comfort level was really important with coaches, at least some coaches. Borsas is not a guy who's all about the money. You know, he's about comfort. He's about where he feels comfortable, and that's something that he felt, I know, at Green Bay extensively. He was very comfortable at Green Bay, and he had a lot of success that reflected in, you know, them making the NCAA tournament almost every year and him winning it almost every year. He dominated that conference when he was there. And so, you know, his contract was getting near the end here, and if he didn't have an extension, you know, he didn't have the security here, and if he thought he could get it somewhere else, you know, maybe he had a read on, you know, he should take that where he could be secure. I think that there's a lot of issues still involved there that we don't know about, and I think that maybe Mick could speak to it a little bit better than me, but I know that Kevin definitely liked being in Green Bay when he was there, and I'm sure that played some of a role in this situation.
Okay. Hey, Mark, I want to thank you for joining me. Always a pleasure talking with you, my friend. You know we'll have you back on again, especially in the fall when we get to fall practice. Yeah, we'll be talking a lot of football then, buddy.
Thank you so much, Earl.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Yep, bye-bye. And that's Mark Snyder talking with us, talking football with us right here on AM 870 WKAR. It's 41 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for more sports talk after this short break right here on AM 870 WKAR.
Did you know that New York City waters are an important shark destination, or that coyotes are traveling across the Big Apple to Long Island? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at biodiversity in our cities, the species that thrive, the threats, and conservation efforts. That's on Science Friday from NPR.
And that's Science Friday coming up on Talk of the Nation at 3 o'clock right here on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening today. I'm Scott Pohl with the weather. Today will be sunny, and we're expecting a high of 58 degrees. Tonight, areas of frost return, mostly clear with a low of 28. Sunny tomorrow, the high in the low 60s. Mostly sunny Sunday with a slight chance of some rain and a high of 59.
And give us a call. Our lines are open, 355-9527. Toll free, 877-9527-870. Our email address, sportstalk@wkar.org. Well, now we're going to talk a little bit more about what's been the buzz around the NFL, the bounty situation. Matter of fact, as I told some of you yesterday, I had a chance to talk with Harlan Barnett about bounties going on when he was playing, and he said there weren't many bounties going on. He said what they did back in his day when he was playing is that they put the money in a hat, and they put money on who got the big hits or who got the pick or anything like that. But no bounties like he's been hearing today. We're going to talk with Dave Burkett from the Detroit Lions about the bounties that we've been reading about. And is that, do we think it's deeper than what it is? So, Dave, let me bring you in. Do you think the bounty situation is maybe deeper than what it has been, buddy?
I think so, Earl. I mean, you know, I've talked to a handful of players about this, and you know, I don't think that the Saints were by any means the only team doing this in the league. You know, I think it's a lot more common what you talked about, kind of that pay-for-performance system where you get an interception, you get a fumble, a big hit, you know, maybe you get a couple hundred bucks in the meeting the next week. But, you know, I think it's wrong. Obviously, you can't go target somebody's injuries, a head or a knee or a neck or whatever. But I'm sure that's been talked about in plenty more locker rooms than down in New Orleans.
Yes, you know, because that's been the going. You know, if it is more than that, if it is more than just what we've been reading about, but, it goes to saying that the NFL's got to get that under control, don't they? They've got to get this out of the game. We can't have this kind of head-hunting and, you know, injuring players specifically. That's definitely not good for the game. And I think, Roger Goodell seems to be going about it in the right way.
Right, I think that's why you saw him come down so hard on the Saints and obviously management and coaches, and I think you're going to see him come down hard on the players too, because this is something that maybe it has been going on other places, but it needs to stop now, especially in the culture and the climate that the NFL is now with head injuries being such a big deal, you know, the concussion lawsuits that are out there. They really need to put an end to this right now.
And with New Orleans having 22 players, I don't see players getting suspended. I see they'll probably get big fines. But you don't think that they could suspend? That would really cripple the team if they had to face suspension, or would it just be a fine for most of those guys?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Obviously, I don't know. I'm not privy to all the evidence that they have, but you know, I think the accusations against Jonathan Vilmos throwing $10,000 on the table and saying if you knock somebody out, you know, that might rise to a suspension. But I think you're right. You know, I don't know that you can suspend 22 to 26 players as the NFL alleges has been involved in this. You know, I don't think you can knock them all, you know, four games and suspend them all for the first 4 weeks of the season. I think even if not all those guys are still on the Saints, I think that leads to an unfair advantage. So you might see. I think you'll probably see some suspensions. You know, you'll definitely see some fines, and you might see those rolled out over a short period of time.
Okay. We got Pachu on the line. Pachu, how you doing?
All right. How you doing, Earl?
Okay.
I didn't get your guest name, but I want to say thank you
for
coming
Dave
on.
Yeah, Dave Burkett. Yeah.
Hey, Pachu.
How you doing? Thanks for coming on. Here's my comment and my question. Several decades ago, when I used to watch a lot of boxing, I saw this fight between the now manager of Pacquiao with another individual who was managed in the corner by Panama Lewis. And at the end of the fight, and this fighter had been cut up very, very badly. I mean, he was bloodied. He eventually went to the hospital, almost died. Do you recall that fight, Earl?
Yes.
Okay, when the winning fighter who beat this individual, manager Pacquiao, I don't remember his name, his father was working his corner. Anyway, when he went to shake the fighter's hand, the winner, he pulled on the gloves and he found out that he had removed horsehair. And that allowed him to hit harder and to cut his face up. So they charged him criminally. Okay, and I think he was found guilty of some kind of felonious assault charges. Now, what I find disturbing in this case is I don't see how this is different. Except, you know, you're disguising athletics, but at the same time, you're assaulting people. Could your guest please explain to me the difference, how it is not a criminal act to encourage players to do this if players do this?
Good question. Yeah, did you hear that, Mark? I mean, Dave?
You know, I don't foresee any criminal charges. And I think it's one thing for Greg Williams to go in the locker room or go in the meeting and say, hey, let's take out this guy's ACL. It's another to prove that a guy's trying to do it. You know, and again, talking to players, I think even this is both current and former players. I think even if a coach says something like that, I don't think every player is necessarily following it. You know, I think it's one thing to pay for performance, to pay for a big hit, you know, something that's always been glorified in the NFL. But I think, by and large, players across the league are concerned about another player's health. When you see somebody get hurt, it's usually the guy who delivers the blow that's the one waving towards the sideline for the cart. You know, they know right away. I think there's a mutual respect that goes on across the league. So I think Greg Williams and the coaching staff and the management of the Saints are more at fault than the players. And maybe on some level, you know, I don't know if we should take Greg Williams at his word for all this. It's definitely wrong to say that, and that's not to minimize what he did, but you know, it could just be him getting carried away and saying words like that, too.
Yes.
Dave, do you remember Daryl Stenger, the man who died from that hit from the assassin from the Oakland Raiders?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't remember that.
He became quadriplegic and eventually died prematurely. Earl, you remember that, don't you?
Oh, yes.
And there was discussion of whether or not there should be criminal charges there. The other thing is, if the coach is suspended, and I haven't kept close attention to it, but if the coach is suspended, he gets paid, what, $7 million a year? And other coaches are suspended.
Yeah, but they're not getting paid while they're suspended.
Yeah, but that's my point. If it is so serious that you lose millions of dollars, why isn't it serious enough to be criminal charges involved? In this case,
well, you got to prove it. I mean, is that like Dave just said, you know, it's one thing to say it, but it's hard. It's still hard to prove.
Earl, before you came on, I just heard a recording of the coach telling those players to go out there and hurt this injured player.
Yeah, exactly. I heard the same ones. I heard the same ones, but you still have to prove it. I mean, just because somebody says it doesn't mean that the players are actually going out and doing it. You know, I could say you can go hit somebody, and but are you going to do it or not? That's up to you. And that's the thing. You can't prove it.
And I think players have talked about, you know, one of the guys that I talked to yesterday about, I say, you know, you hear it all the time, let's go kill him. You know, let's go hit him as hard as we can. And, of course, they're trying to do that, but obviously not in a literal sense. So that's why I say I don't think all the players necessarily took what Greg Williams said to heart.
Yeah, let's go kill him and pay somebody $10,000. So, anyway, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Pachu. John, hi, John, how you doing?
There's always been trash talking in sports. Joe Namath, Muhammad Ali, Jack Tatum. I don't think this is any different. unless a guy intentionally hurts somebody, I don't think they should be fined. Players are always going to talk trash from NFL, college, high school, pro. It doesn't matter. Unless a guy actually intentionally hurts somebody, I don't think they should be fined. In fact, in my opinion, the players from today's NFL are soft compared to Jack Tatum. Dick Buckus, players like that. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree. That's just my opinion.
Earl, that's why this is such a hot button topic.
You see,
the last two, your last two callers have been on both sides of the fence here. You know,
yes. So
I mean, look, it's wrong. Greg Williams can't say what he said. You know, that's crossing the line, especially in the day and age that the NFL is now, especially what we know about concussions and head injuries and just the toll that playing in the NFL takes on a player's body. You know, like I said, I don't know that Greg meant every word that he said. I don't know enough, you know, about I haven't seen enough of the evidence to know whether, you know, all players or all of these 22 to 26 players that were mentioned that, you know, took this to heart and really tried to injure players. You know, talking to Lions, who played against the Saints twice last year, a couple of those guys have said they didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. They saw nothing that led them to believe they were bounties. So, you know, I think some players do deserve some sort of punishment if you're kind of like Greg and throwing money on the table for that. That's against NFL rules. But, you know, I think, like I said, I think Roger Goodell is, as much as anything, he's punishing the Saints, A, for lying and not coming clean over those 2 years of the investigation, and B, to make this stop, make sure it doesn't go on in future years.
Yeah, and you know, it's another part which no one's talking about or hasn't been mentioned, Dave, is that, you know, yes, he might have threw it out, say, oh, yeah, we'll give you $100,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 for a hit. And some guys we know will try to go out there and pretend to get that money without doing the damage, as you know. As we know, a lot of players, we'll try, or they'll faint, or they might think that they got the hit, but they didn't hit him as hard as, you know, what the bounty's going to be. So there's a lot of ifs about there. It's just not as cut and dry as some people are trying to make it out to be.
That's right. I think, again, you know, when you try to injure somebody, that's wrong, but that's not going to take the physicality out of the game. You know, these guys are smack trucks hitting into each other every week. And, you know, that part of the game is always going to be glorified. That's part of the reason, part of the draw to the NFL. And I don't think that's going away.
And yes, and these guys, as we know, are so big and so fast. It's just amazing how fast the game has gotten. The interior linemen are fast, the outside linemen are fast, all the offensive linemen are fast. The game is a lot faster than what it was 5 to even 10 years ago. We see the players are just, it's amazing how fast the players are in that league, isn't it, Dave?
And Earl, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about that. If you see it up close, if you listen to it up close, and, you know, you can get a sense of it from NFL Network, some of the sound effects, you know, shows that they have. But if you see it up close, it's amazing that these guys' bodies aren't more wrecked. But Earl, just one other point, and I can't remember who the player was, but this is from back in the 50s or the 60s. I read this the other day. Bounties have been going on forever, obviously. And there's one player, you know, you weren't making a lot of money at the time, but I read where it was a defensive player told the offensive player, hey, we got a, you know, $500 bounty or something like that on you. And the offensive player said, well, I'll pretend to be injured, and how about we split it? So I think it's something that, you know, to your original point, yeah, it's been going on. It's been a part of the league for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I can see that happening for sure. Players, everybody wants to get their cut, you know, in football, as we know, because the players aren't, we know for a fact, they aren't overpaid. A few players are overpaid, but the majority of players are probably playing, you know, for something along the lines that they should probably make. That's one thing we see. We don't see that many players being overpaid in the NFL, do we?
No, a large portion of the roster is making the league minimum. You know, and I think that it's fair to point out that their contracts are not guaranteed like they are in baseball or basketball. And, you know, so you see a guy that has maybe a three-year career span anyways, and obviously he's making real good money for those first 3 years. But, you know, their bodies go through a ton of punishment, and their careers are real short. I'd never fault any player for getting what he can while he can, because the earning power in that league can disappear like that.
You know, Dave, I've always been surprised that they've had chances in their collective bargaining agreements in the past to try to get some summer free agency, but the players have never really went after free agency that strong. Why don't you think players will go after free agency a little bit harder?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of free agency, it's there for him. You know, obviously after 4 years, 3 years, you're restricted. You know, I think that the thing that the players would love are when they look around at some of these other leagues and they see these guaranteed contracts. But I don't ever see the owners, you know, the teams going that way because of that injury factor, because of how wrecked their bodies get. You know, you can't give a guy, guarantee a guy 5 years when there's a very good likelihood in year one or year two his body's going to break down and not be able to last.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, Dave, I want to thank you. It's always a pleasure talking with you, my friend. And we'll get back more when we get to the fall, when the Lions go to camp, because there's still a lot of excitement around Lions football. As we know, everyone is anticipating a very good year for the Detroit Lions.
Should be. Hey, we'll see. I mean, it's 10 come up, 10-win season. They got most of those guys back. It should be real. So we'll do it again.
Okie dokie. Hey, thanks a lot, Dave. Hey, we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. And that's Dave Burkett talking sports with us right here on AM 870 WKR. A lot of excitement around the Detroit Lions. And, Jacob, are you feeling that Lions excitement? Do you feel the Lions could be potentially a very good team this year?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's, after last season and what's coming up, I think that's definitely a decent expectation. I don't think that's shooting for the stars or anything like that. I think they could potentially be a very good team this year, yes.
Yes, they could be. It seems like they've got a lot of players that can suit up for them, whether they're on the line or, they're special teamers. They've got a lot of good players in that system. And you just wonder, can they hold on to so many of these players? There a lot of them are, playing, like Dave say, playing for the minimum wage, playing for what they can get under the minimum of their contract. So that's the question. Can they, if they have to give out a lot of raises, how can they handle it? That's what I'm always wondering. Can the Lions get everybody under the salary cap and keep that team viable?
Yeah, I guess, that we'll see. That's definitely that's one of the things that comes with, being a successful team like that, is you do have added problems with, with money and whatnot, and everybody wanting more of it and all that. So, I guess we'll see. That's something they have to work out. But
there was the Crosstown Showdown was played last night between the Lugnuts and of course, Michigan State. Well, we talked with Coach Jake Boss Jr., and he talked about how well the team played.
Well, I thought we played okay. Obviously, we saw some pretty good arms, and with a wood bat that we're not really used to playing with, you didn't really expect to put a big number up on the board. But, again, we had some guys that really threw it well, I thought. We played, defensively fairly well, and, our guys, I think, enjoyed themselves. It was a good night.
And then he also had one thing. Well, they only had one inning get away from them, the Michigan State did. So they just had one bad inning, and I asked him about that one inning that got away from them.
Yeah, I think we had a lot of guys that really did throw well tonight, and, we played good defense, and unfortunately one inning kind of got away from us. But, when you look at the big picture against a good organization with a lot of really talented guys, overall I think, we're pretty pleased.
And they're playing Michigan today. They've got the first of a three-game series. They'll play Michigan tomorrow here in McLean Stadium, tomorrow's game. So this is a three-game series for the weekend. Michigan has two games there, and Michigan State will have a game here. And that's a very big game in a very big series. They had to try to get everybody in. They tried to play everybody last night for that game. Against the Lugnuts, but it was a good game, and the players enjoyed it, and the fans enjoyed it. The largest crowd ever in their stadium, over 12,997 fans. Hey, I want to thank you all for coming today, and thank you all for listening. We invite you to come back and join us again on Monday, right here on AM 870 WKAR. You've been listening to Michigan State University Radio, AM 870 WKAR East Lansing. We come your way Monday through Friday from 1:05 to 2 o'clock right here on WKAR. If you've never called us before, we invite you to come back and be a first-time caller. Call us on Monday afternoon right here on AM 870. Have yourself a very safe and pleasant evening, and we'll look forward to talking to you again on Monday afternoon right here on AM 870 WKAR.
Thanks for listening to Sports Talk with Earl Robinson from AM 870 WKAR.